I hope you will put up with a little of my foolishness, but you're already doing that. I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. But I do not think I am in the least inferior to those super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge. We have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. And when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. I have kept myself from being a burden to you in any way and will continue to do so. As surely as the truth of Christ is in me, nobody in the regions of Achaia will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. And I will keep on doing what I am doing in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising, then, if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve.
Good, can I have my welcome? My name's Richard Bray. I helped to lead the talks here, and this is the second in our series back in 2 Corinthians, which we were looking at in the autumn and we came back to last week. And over these 4 weeks, we're asking the question, how do we judge who to listen to and who to follow? Especially in matters of religion. There are many voices out there among our colleagues on the television, on the radio, the newspapers, books we might read, sermons we might download, churches we might go along to. How do we decide who to listen to and who to follow? Maybe we just drift along to the church that's closest to us, or where there are other people like us, or where it's simply what we're used to. Maybe we look for somewhere with great music, or where the leaders seem particularly impressive or inspiring. In Corinth, in the first century, it seems that people were willing to listen more and more to new persuasive teachers who were coming into the church, listening less and less to the Apostle Paul, who had started the church there and who had some important warnings for them. We're going to see today that who we listen to matters. Who we follow matters. Which church we attend, which Christian leaders we read and listen to, which talks we download, which TV preachers we watch, all these things matter. These things aren't just a question of personal preference. The gospel itself, and therefore our salvation, depends on it. Paul tells us, first of all, the importance of being discerning. I've called it on the sheet there, the trouble with tolerance. The trouble with tolerance. It's not really the dumb thing in our culture today, is it, to criticise others? Certainly not publicly. The most loving and fair way to relate to people, we think, is to be accepting. We might have personal preferences, but that's all that they are, personal. And this idea is found most strongly, maybe, in Christian circles. It's right that Christians must be marked by love, not a harsh, critical spirit. But we tend to think that it's unchristian to point out weaknesses in other Christian leaders' teaching. I might not share that emphasis, but it's unacceptable, we think, for me to criticise it. Those Christian leaders who do sometimes speak up and criticise others are seen as divisive and arrogant. Do you recognise that description? I wonder whether a similar thing was going on in Corinth. In the opening verses of chapter 11, Paul contrasts what the church there were willing to put up with or tolerate with an appeal for them to put up with him in his criticism of the new teachers. We can see that in verse 4, if you'll just look down. He says, if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. And yet Paul has to appeal in verse 1 for them to put up with him as he tries to show them that that's what's going on. Presumably the Corinthians didn't think that the new teachers coming in among them were preaching another Jesus, a different spirit, a different gospel. But that's Paul's assessment, and he wants them to hear him out as he argues for it. For Paul to speak against the new teachers was probably seen as self-interested sour grapes. They probably thought, oh, here's Paul, he feels bitter that we're not following him anymore, that we're listening to these other influences in the church. People preferred, it seems, the much smoother, more affirming words of the new teachers. But Paul's criticisms weren't just petty personal carping. Just look at his motivation down there in verses 2 and 3. He says, I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. I promised you to one husband, says Paul. He paints himself as the matchmaker, or more likely, the father, who has promised his daughter's hand in marriage. For him, it's the Corinthian church that he's promised in marriage to Christ. One of the most wonderful pictures of the Christian message is that the church is the bride pledged to be married to Jesus Christ on the day he returns. And Paul's concern is that the church in Corinth, his precious daughter, pledged to Christ, will keep herself pure until the marriage is consummated, until her wedding night. You see, it's not for the father's sake that he's concerned with who his daughter is hanging out with and being influenced by. He has a divine concern for their own sakes. I'm sure those of us who have daughters will be able to understand that sort of concern, won't we? Now the Corinthians would say, look, Dad, you're worrying about nothing. You're worrying about nothing. We just want to get to know our bridegroom, Christ, better. But Paul, the older and wiser father in the faith, he's seen it all before. He knows the seduction of the serpent right back at in the Garden of Eden. Remember how at the fall in Genesis 3, the serpent promised a better experience of the very blessings that God was giving. He tempted Eve and Adam by subtly suggesting that what they had wasn't quite enough. And before they knew it, they were reaching out for a substitute saviour. That was the danger in Corinth. The Corinthians thought they were just expressing their personal preferences, listening to the impressive Christian preachers and teachers, and that Paul was just an out-of-touch, foolish old fuddy-duddy to be warning them about it. That he had the jealous anxiety of a father watching his daughter flirt with the biggest mistake of her life. Do you see the trouble with tolerance? In matters of ultimate beliefs, it is dangerous not to be discerning. We hate conflict. We feel ill-equipped, maybe, to judge between different Christian teachers and claims. But decide we must. The battleground as we saw last week, is in the realm of convictions and knowledge. Just as the serpent in Genesis tempted Eve and Adam with the knowledge of good and evil, so here the danger is that their minds might be led astray from Christ. It's as if we're so dazzled by the impressiveness of these new teachers coming into the church, the warm glow that they convey, the success as they draw crowds to them, that we find ourselves being drawn in. And before we know it, our minds are changed. Who we listen to matters. Who we follow matters. What we think matters. How do you decide who to listen to, who to follow, what to think? Without knowing it, we can find ourselves accepting another Jesus, a different spirit, a different gospel. We put up with a variety of Christian teaching on the grounds of tolerance, maybe, but we don't put up with those who warn against the false teachers. Paul goes on later to show some of the consequences of putting up with these false teachers. If you've got your own Bible, you'll be able to follow verse 19. He says we're actually putting up with fools. Verse 20, he says, in fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you, or exploits you, or takes advantage of you, or pushes himself forward, or slaps you in the face. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. The history of the Christian church is sadly littered with stories of big, flashy, successful Christian leaders who have grown to like the influence they have over their followers and have grown to abuse that relationship. And their flock have accepted it or even been complicit. The obvious example, I suppose, if you can think back to the mid-90s, was the wildly successful 9 o'clock service in Sheffield. Do you remember the scandal there? The leader, who looked so impressive, had drawn hundreds, if not thousands, to this modern, impressive service. He was exposed as sexually abusing a number of young women in the congregation. And then there have been the scandals more recently in the Roman Catholic Church. But most situations like this are much less public and much less obvious. There have been churches here in London in the last few years where impressive, successful leaders have drawn a crowd. They've grown to relish their influence over their congregations, and they've grown to abuse that relationship. It may not be sexual abuse that's going on. It may be that they simply develop an unchallenged authority. They insist on having things their way. They refuse accountability over how they spend church funds, how they make decisions in church life, what they demand of their followers. And people put up with it. There's something about us, I think, isn't there, that likes to be dominated, likes to find a strong leader and find security in following them. Like the serpent in the garden, these situations never look dangerous at the outset. Those who start to tinkle the warning bell are made to look divisive and petty. We're told it's unchristian to criticise one another. These people's flaws are overlooked because they're successful. And before we know it, we're following another Jesus. No Jesus at all. That's the trouble with tolerance. The particular error which the Corinthian church was in danger of being seduced into is incredibly contemporary. We can see that as we move on, secondly, to a warning about worldliness. The Corinthian church seemed to want to stop listening to Paul and to follow the new leaders instead because of two entwined issues: a worldly view of Christian ministry and a worldly view of money. In terms of Christian ministry, we said last week that the orators of the time were expected to be eloquent, powerful, and persuasive in their speech. They spent many years training their voices and learning the art of rhetoric. We can hear the echo of their criticism of Paul's ministry in verses 4 and 5. He says, I do not think that I'm in the least inferior to those super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge. We've made this perfectly clear to you in every way. But the particular way that presents in this passage is a worldly view of money and how money is used to pay for Christian ministry. You see, in Corinth, preachers were expected to collect significant sums of money from those who came to listen to them. It's as if here at the Cuban, someone would stand up and give the talk for 20 minutes or so, and then we'd go round with the bucket. We're not going to do that. It's lunchtime, by the way. But that's the sort of practice that would have been there in Corinth, it seems. And we would have shown, as hearers, you would have shown your own impressiveness, your own piety, your own approval by being seen to put large notes in the bucket. Maybe it is a good idea, after all, I don't know. Now, it was a measure of how you were doing as a preacher, how much money you made from it. And actually, it was an opportunity for the hearers to feel good about themselves as they were patrons of an impressive leader. Oh, I give money, I support such and such a preacher. Now, I wonder whether it's still like that today. Whether we like to think that we pay for the best. There's a reason, I think, why Stella Artois have chosen the advertising slogan that they have. Reassuringly expensive. We like to think that we're paying for the best, don't we? We're suspicious of freebies. And I think we might share some of the Corinthians' pride in showing the trappings of success in how we look after our pastors, our leaders. It's certainly the case, I think, that we take a certain amount of pride in how our church buildings are kitted out, whether we've got the latest technology, audiovisual equipment, carpets, chairs, whatever else it might be, glossy publicity. But it might too be in how we look after our pastors. A friend of mine went to work for a church in the States a few years ago, and before long, someone in the congregation had given him a BMW. Now, I don't know whether that car was given to him simply as a very generous act of generosity, or whether there was some pride there, whether that church wanted to show that we look after our pastor, and it was shameful to see him catching a bus or riding a bike or whatever he did before he had his BMW. Now, this desire to pay to make our pastors and their ministry look good is more obvious maybe in some church circles than others. Sometimes Christians think that putting our leaders on pedestals helps display the victory of Christ. Have you seen that maybe in church life? We think it makes Christianity look more attractive, maybe, if our leaders dress in fine robes and we fill our buildings with that gold and velvet. Or maybe it's not quite that church culture. Maybe it's if our leaders have shiny white teeth and drive the Mercedes or the BMW. My own church background isn't about either of those things. It's not about performance ritual or the prosperity gospel. But I think we still find the attitude that wants the best of everything. It's not too hard to imagine some churches within evangelical circles, which is what I'm from conservative churches, which is where I'm from, where it's an exaggeration, but not too far, to imagine the promotional video on the church website. You know, here we don't just have any preaching. This is M&S preaching. Can you imagine it? All right, I'm exaggerating, but it's not far off. And by contrast, we can maybe feel a bit embarrassed or frustrated if our church isn't like that. There are some very impressive churches here in London, and it can be easy to feel the poor relation. Maybe your church building is a little bit shabby. Maybe your services aren't always as slick and uplifting as they could be. The music isn't great, and your preachers aren't making a name for themselves. Do those things matter? Well, what did Paul say? He said, verse 7, "Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge?" Was it a sin? You see, far from being the M&S preacher, he was the Poundland preacher. No, he wasn't the Poundland preacher even. He was the street beggar, wasn't he? He humbled himself by refusing their money and relying instead on the charity of the poorer people upcountry in Macedonia. Now that was offensive to the wealthy Corinthians. They were used to patronising their preachers, and in the world's eyes they were much more successful than the Macedonians. It would have been embarrassing and shameful to be listening to a preacher who wasn't reliant on your support but was reliant on the giving from the country bumpkins in Macedonia. Paul sarcastically repeats the allegation against him in verse 8. I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. He doesn't really think that he was robbing those churches, but that's the allegation against him. But Paul didn't want to encourage their worldly thinking. You see, the victory of Christ is not displayed in the impressiveness and prosperity of the preacher. There will be plenty of time for that in heaven. In Paul's apparently pathetic model of ministry, he was actually following the pattern of Jesus Christ himself. In Matthew's Gospel, chapter 23, verse 12, Jesus used exactly the same words in the Greek when he said, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. The same words as those in verse 7. You see, Paul, in his refusal to go in for the worldly use of money that was expected of him, he was deliberately overturning the worldliness of the Corinthians by modelling himself on Jesus Christ. Just as Jesus gave himself up to death on a cross on behalf of his people, so Paul willingly rejected the money that would have made his ministry so much more acceptable in the eyes of the Corinthians. He humbled himself in order to teach them a powerful lesson. In refusing the money of the wealthy Corinthians and insisting on preaching to them free of charge, even accepting the help of the Macedonians, Paul was not undermining his message. It was not a shameful thing. It wasn't admitting that his preaching wasn't worth paying for. No, it was deliberately subverting the worldliness of the Corinthians by shockingly modelling himself on Jesus Christ. Let me say that again. He was deliberately subverting the worldliness of the Corinthians by shockingly modelling himself on Jesus Christ. The Corinthian way, elevating their leaders in order to display the triumph of Christ, showed that they hadn't really understood the Christian message at all. The victory of Christ came through suffering, came through humility, came through willingly emptying himself and being put to shame on the cross. And so Paul deliberately subverts the culture in order to draw attention to their mistake. Just look down to verses 10 3 to 12. He says, as surely as the truth of Christ is in me, nobody in the regions of Achaia will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. And I will keep on doing what I am doing in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. Do you see what he's saying? He wants to deliberately show up these false teachers who are running him down in their motivations. He wants them to see just how worldly those people are. You see, it would have been so easy for Paul just to take the money and fit in with the culture, wouldn't it? His ministry would have been much more acceptable to the church. Do you know, if I was in Paul's shoes, I think I'd have taken the money. I'd have done everything I could to fit their expectations, especially if it meant accepting money. I would tell myself that I wasn't presenting any obstacle to the message. I would remind myself that Paul told the Corinthians, this very church, in an earlier letter, to be all things to all people. So if they want to give you money, well, take it. That's what I would convince myself, I think. But I would have been conforming to the culture at precisely the point where it needed to be challenged. There's a great emphasis in training people for ministry, especially cross-cultural Bible teaching ministry. There's a great emphasis on what's known as cultural contextualization. that is fitting in with the culture around us and doing ministry in a way that's appropriate and understandable and acceptable to the culture around us. And that's good and right. But do you see that Paul says here that he's explaining and living out the gospel in a way that leads to a maximum clash with the culture around? And actually, as we stop and think about it, that's always what Paul does with regard to money. Have you ever noticed in the New Testament and Paul's various letters that he always has an attitude to money in the different churches, in the different regions, depending on what leads to the maximum clash with the culture around? In Thessalonica, people were tempted to think when they became Christians that they could sit back and rely on handouts from Christians elsewhere. No, Paul says, you should work hard to earn your money, to buy yourself bread. And so he worked as a tent maker in Thessalonica to show by example that we must still work hard when we become Christians. When he was writing to Timothy in Ephesus, where people were tempted to disregard the authority of their elders and look down on them, he told Timothy to insist that the worker deserves his wages. Pastors should be paid by their congregation. And in Corinth, he neither says that he worked as a tent maker here, nor does he say the worker deserves his wages, I need to be paid for the work that I'm doing. Paul could have lived comfortably in Corinth on their giving. He could have had a ministry that was much more socially acceptable. But in Corinth, he deliberately chose to offend their worldly assumptions by working for nothing. So what about us? Where do we fit too easily with our culture and its expectations? In your workplace, are you solely concerned with cultural contextualization? Or are you willing to humble yourself in order to show the anti-gospel nature of the culture around you? In our lunchtime talks here at the Cuban, Wednesday lunchtimes, we try to fit in with the culture by dressing snappily and spending money on good publicity and whatever else. But are there ways in which we need to be deliberately creating a clash with the culture of the offices around here rather than conforming to it? I don't know the answer. Maybe you can discuss it around your tables afterwards. In your church at home, how is your pastor, how are your church leaders remunerated? How do we look after them? What do you expect from your leaders? What does the building look like? What are the priorities in the church budget? Are you doing Christianity in a worldly way, or are you deliberately subverting the cultural expectations around you? Paul is willing to suffer, willing to live as a beggar in order to show up the worldliness of the new teachers in Corinth. The new teachers who looked so impressive and whose message didn't seem much different to Paul's, I imagine. They were teaching the Bible, they would have been respected as faithful Christian leaders. And yet they revealed, through their worldly attitude to money and their worldly conduct of ministry, that they didn't belong to Jesus at all. Paul says, doesn't he? But in fact, they were servants of Satan. Strong words, isn't it? Who do you listen to? And who do you follow? More next week. For now, let's pray. Our Father, please teach us to judge rightly as we look at our own life and conduct, as we think about how we present to our friends and our colleagues, as we judge who to listen to in religious matters, whether we're committed to a particular church, whether we're looking for a church, or whether we're just tasting what's on offer in various places. Please, Father, give us the wisdom and discernment to look beyond the worldly impressiveness, to think critically about who we listen to and who we follow. Please raise up pastors and leaders and preachers who are willing to humble themselves in order to subvert the culture around them for the sake of the salvation of their flock. In Jesus' name. Amen.